From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Ted Koppel and Bill Maher are now back-to-back late nights on ABC, and they're back-to-back on this archive edition of Fresh Air. We'll talk with Koppel about pressing politicians and newsmakers for the truth on Nightline, and we'll talk to comic Bill Maher about the irreverent roundtables he moderates on Politically Incorrect. Also, actress Sarah Jessica Parker. She began her performing career as Annie on Broadway. She's currently appearing in the films First Wives Club, Mars Attacks, and The Substance of Fire, and she's starring on Broadway in Once Upon a Mattress. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Crews have begun recovering bodies from yesterday's commuter plane crash near Detroit. Roger Adams of member station WDET reports.
All 29 people aboard Comair Flight 3272 died when the plane went down on its approach to Detroit Metro Airport from Cincinnati. It's been snowing steadily at the crash site, and Monroe County Sheriff Tillman Crutchfield says the weather is slowing body recovery efforts. After all of the bodies are moved to a temporary morgue, the National Transportation Safety Board will begin its investigation. For National Public Radio, this is Roger Adams in Monroe County, Michigan.
Vice President Al Gore is in California today observing the flood damage in the Northwest. He's also planning to visit Idaho and Washington, accompanied by Federal Emergency Management Director James Lee Witt. California officials say damage is already more than $1.5 billion, and they haven't stopped counting yet. Thousands of people are still out of their homes because of high water. 1 billion Muslims worldwide are observing the start of the holy month of Ramadan. NPR's Suni Khalid reports from Cairo.
Muslim clerics throughout the Middle East declared the beginning of Ramadan after certifying the sighting of the new moon. For the next 29 to 30 days, Muslims are required to fast from sunup to sundown to celebrate God's revelation of the Quran, the Muslim holy book, to the Prophet Muhammad almost 1,400 years ago. During the fasting hours, Muslims are not allowed to eat, drink, smoke, or have sexual relations. Special exemptions from fasting are granted to the sick, pregnant women, and travelers. In Egypt and elsewhere in the Muslim world, the daily end of fasting is marked by religious seminars as well as feasts and other festive celebrations. The end of Ramadan is celebrated with Eid al-Fitr, a three-day feast. I'm Suni Khalid in Cairo.
Turkey says it's prepared to attack the island of Cyprus to block the deployment of newly purchased Russian missiles. But the United States is warning Ankara against making such a threat. Tension over Cyprus has now increased between Turkey and Greece. Cyprus has been divided since 1974 when Turkey sent in troops to protect the island's Turkish minority after a rather brief coup by Cypriots who wanted to unify with Greece. Only Turkey recognizes the Turkish Cypriot state that was created in the north. Miami police aren't having much luck tracking down missing money from a Brinks truck that fell on its side 2 days ago. $500,000 in spilled money is missing. It showered a Miami neighborhood, and police are asking residents to return the money. No questions asked. But they haven't gotten much of a response. Authorities plan to go on asking for the money in a door-to-door search. Those caught could face charges ranging from misdemeanors to grand theft. There's just been one arrest so far, a man who allegedly hit a highway trooper while trying to get to the money. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, on Wall Street, stock prices are down 28 points at 6,597. They were off more sharply earlier today when the Labor Department released the unemployment data for December. The government says the jobless rate was unchanged at 5.3%. But a separate report finds 262,000 jobs were created last month. The news was unexpected, and stock and bond traders are increasingly worried about inflation and higher interest rates. Economist David Weiss says the report had more strong economic news.
Not only were job increases high, the average work week went up again. The manufacturing work week is now at a record high, as is overtime. What worries the Fed probably most of all is the increasing average hourly earnings, which jumped another nickel.
The bond market plunged this morning as well. The benchmark 30-year Treasury bond was off. Its yield pushed up to 6.88 points. Japanese stocks plunged more than 4.25% today. The Nikkei finished the worst trading week since 1990. Investors are worried that the government won't be able to revive the nation's sluggish economy. The banking sector is particularly struggling. Banks and other lenders are having trouble writing off trillions of yen in defaulted loans left over from the 1980s. The burden of the bank debt is dragging down the whole economy. Banks cannot loan more money to companies to build or expand production. Federal Reserve Board Governor Lawrence Lindsay is resigning. Lindsay, who's been with the Fed for more than 5 years, sent a letter to President Clinton yesterday saying his resignation is effective on February 1st. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for this program comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting public understanding of the changing relationship between family and workplace.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Late nights on ABC TV just changed. Now the newsmakers and analysts on Nightline are followed by comics, actors, and pundits on Politically Incorrect. On this archive edition, we'll hear from Politically Incorrect's host, Bill Maher, and from Ted Koppel. Koppel has been the host of Nightline since its inception in 1980. Nightline evolved from America Held Hostage, ABC's late-night specials during the Iranian hostage crisis. When the crisis began, Koppel was ABC's senior diplomatic correspondent. He and former Nightline producer Kyle Gibson collaborated on a book called Nightline when it was published last spring. I asked Ted Koppel how the ground rules at Nightline have changed since the show's early days. Ground rules about whether the show is live or taped and whether guests are in the studio or at remote locations.
Those have changed a little, but probably less than people think. I remember about 7 or 8 years ago, the New York Times Magazine did a story on Nightline in which the writer of that story discovered that my great edge and what gave me this terrific edge on the air was the fact that I never, ever, ever sat down in a studio face-to-face with someone, and it was always done electronically. Well, I knew that wasn't so, but I went and had one of our researchers dig up how many face-to-face interviews I had done that year. And as I say, that was at least 7 or 8 years ago. It turned out to be over 80. I mean, out of 250 shows a year. So it was like one out of four, or one out of three, actually. So we've been doing that for a long time. We tended during the first 10 or 11 years or so, we tended only to do the show live. In the last few years, we have made more exceptions to that. I'd like to say, for the convenience of our guests, it's really more for my convenience than anybody else's. I sort of got tired of never seeing my wife, and my wife got tired of never seeing me during the week. When you have done about 3,000 or 4,000 of these programs, it starts to get a little bit old. And we found that there were things we could actually do by pre-taping that made the show more interesting, more exciting, and improved the quality of it. And so I'd say now probably a couple of shows a week are pre-taped.
Now, the New York Times article that you referred to, the writer made it seem that even if the guest was in Washington, at the ABC headquarters there, you'd put them in a remote studio within the building so that you wouldn't be in the same room eye to eye with them.
No, he didn't make it seem that way. We do that, and we do that to this day, but that's if we have more than one guest on, usually. And the rationale behind that is, it is as though you had two guests on the program now and the other guest was sitting there in Philadelphia with you, whereas I'm down here in Washington. Now, the person who is sitting next to you or across the desk from you has a certain advantage over the person who's in the remote location. So the reason that we do that, even in Washington, is that when we have one or more other guests who may be in a remote location, we're sort of leveling the playing field.
Now, in a previous interview, or maybe it was an article you wrote, I don't recall, you made it seem, too, as if it's easier. When you're in the studio with somebody, you're looking them right in the eye, and you have to just kind of acknowledge their humanity, and it makes it sometimes more difficult to ask a really hard question. It's easier to ask that question if you're not looking at them eye to eye.
No, not for that reason. I have absolutely no... In fact, ironically, the first great exception to the having someone in another studio rule came about precisely because the guest being interviewed knew that I was going to ask him a very personal question, and maybe more than one personal question, and insisted on the right to be able to confront me and look at me eye to eye, and that was Senator Gary Hart, who was running for president, and the question was whether he had been faithful to his wife. And I absolutely understood why he wanted to do that and argued passionately with Rune Arledge that we ought to make that exception and do it, and he agreed. So ironically, when people do have a legitimate reason for saying, look, you're going to get very personal with me, I have no trouble at all sitting across the table from them or sitting next to them at the desk. The point is, if I have more than one guest, and I am just a voice appearing electronically in their earpiece, it does give me a greater sense of control over the program than I might have if I'm sitting there with two or three people in the studio.
You know what I would really like your advice on? You do this so exceptionally well. When somebody is gassing on and they're intentionally evading your answer, you really know how to...
Shut up, Terry. it's easy.
You
right back on your heels there.
But you know how to tactfully get them back to the point and not let them get away with that. How would you describe your approach to keeping a person to the point and holding them accountable?
I have a sort of little alarm that goes off in the back of my head, and... I'll try and explain it to you. I'm not sure if it's going to make a whole lot of sense. I think that every interviewer begins, for example, your listeners begin this program and will probably end this program having you be their surrogate. In other words, they are saying, go for it, Terry. Go after him. Don't let him get away with it. These are the questions we really want to have you ask. And if it sounds as though I'm doing a tap dance and trying to avoid the answer, they will want you to jump in, and they will want you to interrupt me. But there is a sense of fairness about both a listening audience and a viewing audience. And if you were to jump in after the first 30 seconds of my answer, they would probably say, Terry, you don't have to be rude. Give the man a chance to answer. But now, for example, I've already been rambling on for a minute and a half or a minute 40. And if at this point you were to come in and say, Ted, I don't mean to be rude, but I asked you this question and you're actually answering something totally different. By that time, the audience at home is on your side and they're saying, don't let him get away with it. Go for it.
There are several encounters that are reprinted in the Nightline book, and I'd like to read an excerpt of one of them. This was your encounter with Evan Meacham, the governor of Arizona. This was in November of 1987. And you were trying to hold him accountable to a statement that he'd made about homosexuals holding government positions. And he had said that anybody who broke the law shouldn't have a job in government, and a homosexual act is an act against the law. He says, Mr. Koppel, we've had a 30-minute program. You spent the first part of it telling all about the thing. Would you allow me just to respond in a positive way? And you say, no, Governor, I tell you what. You can make all the positive announcements that you want to in the state of Arizona. I told you from the beginning, and I've tried to be as candid with you as I can, you're not here to talk about your accomplishments in office. You're here because you've become a national figure of considerable interest, not because you opened a trade office in Taiwan, not because you've been tough on drugs. Try and answer the question. Now, let's play by my rules for a moment. Let's go back to the question that I asked you initially, and which it seems to me you evaded the first two or three times that I asked you. Were you not calling for the elimination of homosexuals from government office because, in your view, they break the law? Then Meacham says, we've spent so much time on homosexuals. And then you said, you spend so much time evading. If you would just answer the question a little more directly, Governor, then we could have gotten through this in about a minute or two. Boy, I kind of applaud you on that. That's really hard to do, though, isn't it, to be that blunt with somebody?
No, because... Again, there's a sort of invisible line. Governor Meacham was trying to sell the notion that he had been invited on Nightline simply because he was the governor of Arizona. And as the governor of Arizona, there are an awful lot of things that he might want to talk about. And indeed, I perhaps ought to ask him about. But he hadn't been invited just as the governor of Arizona. If he had not taken that very controversial stand, and if he had not said some of the very blunt things that he had said, I don't want to be unkind, but we would not have invited Governor Meacham to be on the program. We didn't have any particular interest in him, in simply in his capacity as governor of Arizona. So to the degree that he wasn't willing to answer any questions on that and he wasn't being responsive, I felt I not only had a right but the obligation to get tough with him.
Now, if it wasn't the governor, but it was, say, the president of the United States who was being that evasive, would you have been as blunt in your challenge to him?
A little tougher. Quite clearly, the president of the United States holds a unique position. And while I hope I have conducted reasonably tough interviews with a variety of presidents of the United States, the level of courtesy that you're obliged to show in that kind of an interview, I think, is in a class by itself.
What's a typical day at work for you like now?
Oh, I usually get up around 8:30 in the morning, and I have 4 or 5 newspapers delivered to the house. And since I'm on NPR, I can say I listen to Morning Edition. And by 11 o'clock, we have our first conference call of the day, and that's when we lock in whatever we're going to be doing that day. When I say lock in, that doesn't mean that if there's a major news story later in the day, we won't change it. We will. But tentatively, we lock it in. And then I usually get into the office around 1 or so in the afternoon, and then it is a day of writing, answering mail, phone calls, meetings. If we're live, I get out of the studio shortly after midnight and get home about 1 in the morning. If we're pre-taping, then sometimes I'm home by 8:30 or 9.
What's the latest in the day you'll change the subject of your show, outside of, like, the breaking, you know, hostage crisis or something?
Well, I was going to say, when President Carter ordered the rescue mission, which went so terribly awry in the desert, I was already on my way home, having done the show, and came back in, and we redid a brand new broadcast at 2:30 in the morning for all our Pacific Coast stations. Before the program, we've changed the program as late as 10 o'clock at night for an 11:30 show.
How nervous that must be. How nervous-making that must be.
Well, actually, there's no time to be nervous. You just, you know, you have to slap something together.
My guest is Ted Koppel. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Ted Koppel. You were born in England in 1940, and your parents were German refugees. Your father, I believe, owned a tire factory in Germany and was imprisoned in Germany in 1938. What was he imprisoned for?
He was imprisoned a little bit earlier. It would have been about 36, maybe early 37. It was very briefly. I mean, my father, I'm Jewish, my parents were Jewish, and That was all you needed to be for the Gestapo to haul you in the late 1930s. The miracle is that he got out.
Why did he get out?
It was still early enough, and he was influential enough in those days and had one very good childhood friend of his who was a prominent judge in Frankfurt, and the judge intervened and got him out, and then said, I may not be able to get you out again the next time. You better get out of here. And he did.
Was it hard for your family to get out of Germany?
No, it was not. It was not hard for them. I mean, clearly, it would have been much, much more difficult a couple of years later. They were not married then. My father got out, I think, in late 36, early 37. My mother got out in 38. They married in 39, and at least that's the story they tell, and I was born in 40.
And I believe your father was interned while in England when the war broke out.
Well, that was the sort of great paradox that hit a lot of German Jews when they arrived in England. Once the war broke out, they were regarded not as Jews but as Germans, and so they were interned as enemy aliens. And my father was interned literally about a month after I was born and spent a year on the Isle of Man. I mean, the conditions were quite good. They were Spartan, but there was no danger, and the people were all treated well. And the British government took the position that, look, we don't know who you are and what your background is. As soon as they were able to confirm for themselves who he was, they let him out again. But that was my mother, who did not speak very much English at that point. Here she was with a 4-week-old baby, and her husband was in the slammer.
Your parents returned to Germany after the war to seek restitution. What did they get back?
A considerable amount of frustration, and then ultimately after...
Which isn't what they were looking for.
No, that's not what they were looking for. But after about, the legal proceedings took in all 7 or 8 years. In 1953, my father finally got some cash as a settlement for factory, home, everything that he had owned in the late 30s. And at that time, I think they decided that America was still the land of the free, home of the brave, and a good place for a young man to grow up and make his fortune. And they were certainly right.
Well, they were certainly right about you. What about your parents, though? How did they adapt to America?
Well, they were by then fairly well along. I mean, by the time we arrived in 1953, my father was 58, my mother was 54. And I still remember my father wanted to start a business in the United States. My mother was really afraid and said, look, you're too old. You don't know the country. You don't know the customs. You don't know how the labor unions operate in this country. And you could lose everything, and then we'd be in really bad shape. So in a sense, my father's professional life ended in 1940 when he was 44 years old, and he was never really able to pick it up again. And I think that was a source of enormous pain and frustration to him.
Did they ever adapt to America, feel comfortable?
I think they did because they really loved how America had treated me and what a wonderful country this was for me. Mm-hmm. And they, as older people frequently do, when they are a generation older than normal parents, the level of living vicariously through your children, and I was their only child, sometimes gets quite intense. And I think they lived the lives that they were not able to complete, really, because of what happened in Germany in the 1930s. They lived a lot of that vicariously through me and saw this as this incredible country where to a considerable extent, not perfectly, and certainly not for everyone, particularly if you are a person of color, but, this is still a great land of opportunity and a land where, it is as close to a meritocracy as I guess exists anywhere in the world.
Tell us more about why you wanted to go into journalism.
As strange as it seems, and it seems very strange to me too, because I'm thinking now that I was no more than 4 or 5 years old when my father used to listen to Edward R. Murrow's broadcasts, which were played back on the BBC, even though he was working for CBS. I remember feeling a sort of intuition that I didn't know who this guy was or precisely what he was doing, but boy, it sounded like a really interesting way to make a living. And I can never remember a time in my life when I didn't want to be a broadcast journalist. I mean, it isn't even that I wanted to, that I wanted to be a journalist, a print journalist. I always wanted to be a radio correspondent. And then when television came along, a television correspondent.
Now, your first job was in radio, wasn't it?
Yes. I started in radio when I went to Syracuse, and I was 16 years old and became an announcer. And one of the reasons that that they gave me a job as an announcer was I spoke French and German, and therefore was able, it was a classical music station, an FM station. And I was one of the only guys around who could pronounce all the names of the composers. So I started off as an announcer on a classical music station, then eventually became the news director and then the program director of the station. And then when I came out, I went to work for a radio station in New York. And then in 1963, I auditioned for a job at ABC Radio and ultimately got it.
When you started to make your way through television, was looks ever an issue for you one way or another?
Well, I thought it was. It's not that anyone told me, hey, Ted, let me give you a good career tip. Try not to appear on camera. But I sort of assumed that that I had not been hired because of my dazzling good looks. And when I first went to Vietnam in 1966-67, I would send pieces back without doing what's called a stand-upper in our business. In other words, the on-camera piece at the top or the on-camera piece at the bottom. And I did it more than anything else because I thought I was then 26, just turned 27. I looked about 18 at the time, and I thought I looked so young that if they see how young I look, and I don't quite know whom I meant by they, probably the audience and also my bosses to a certain extent, that they would say, this guy's much too young to be a television correspondent. So I tried to get away for a while, just sending pieces back without the on-camera top or the on-camera bottom, and then I started getting cables from New York saying, you know, where are the stand-uppers? You know, we need you to do stand-uppers. So I try to make them as short as possible.
Do you think that television is getting any more self-conscious with men about good looks? I mean, do you think it's becoming more important than ever for reporters and anchors to look the part?
I hope not. I think to a certain degree, particularly on local stations around the country, that tends to happen. And I can't deny that for the most part, the people that the networks put on the air as anchors are pretty nice-looking people. But, you know, when I think of my friends Peter Jennings and Dan Rather and Tom Brokaw, I mean, they are all people who have spent many, many years in the trenches, and they're just first-class reporters, too. And the fact of the matter is they also look good. You know, Barbara Walters looks good. Diane Sawyer looks good. But thank God there's Sam Donaldson and me.
Ted Koppel recorded last May after the publication of the book Nightline. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, getting laughs from the news. We talk with Politically Incorrect's Bill Maher. His show just moved from Comedy Central to ABC following Nightline. Also, actress Sarah Jessica Parker. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After a popular run on the Comedy Channel, Politically Incorrect moved this week to ABC following Nightline. Politically Incorrect is a hybrid of The Tonight Show and The McLaughlin Group. Host Bill Maher opens with a comic monologue. Then he brings out his guests to discuss current issues. Guests on a typical show may include a senator, a TV star, a rock star, a think tank scholar, and a stand-up comic. People that are unlikely to talk with each other on any other TV show. Guests have included Jerry Seinfeld, George Stephanopoulos, the president's brother Roger, Senator Arlen Specter, Quentin Tarantino, Al Sharpton, and Sam Donaldson. Last June, I asked Bill Maher if every publicist in America is trying to convince him that their clients are politically astute.
We have a nice thing going now where I think a lot of people want to be on the show, and people do actually solicit our show, whereas we used to have to beg them. But I will also tell you that publicists are very often afraid of this show for their clients because they're afraid that their clients will come on and look stupid. And you know what? They're right. You can come on the show and look stupid. Not that you really have to, you know, be any sort of expert at anything, but I understand the apprehension, and I cannot tell you how many times I have run into celebrities out at functions in L.A., charities and so forth, and have them had them come up to me and say, you know, I'm a big fan of your show. And I'll say, great, I'd love to have you do it. And they say, good, I'd like to. And then 6 months later, I see them again, and they said, why didn't you ever call me? And the truth is, we did call them. We called their publicist, and the publicist never gave them the message because the publicist doesn't want them to do the show.
So what have been your biggest political changes over the years?
Well, I would say that when I was first voting, I probably was very much under my father's wing. And my father was, God bless him, one of the last of the true bleeding heart liberal Kennedy Democrats. Very proud of that. And I'm very proud to be his son. And proud that he was that. But I'm not completely that. Sometimes I am. But I would say, you know, I've learned to sort of think more for myself. But when I was a kid, you know, there was no other way to think about things. I mean, in our household, you know, no one said a bad word about the Kennedys or questioned that very dogmatic line of thinking.
So when you broke with your father's politics, did you become more radical or more conservative?
I would say I became more conservative out of necessity on certain issues, mostly because we are in an era now that doesn't afford liberalism as easy. To be liberal costs a lot of money, which we don't have. My theme is that liberalism is something I really believe we should aspire to, and I would never be proud of being a conservative, but where it's necessary, yes, I'm not going to be stupid about it. If you owe $5 trillion, I'd like to see it paid back. It makes me very nervous to owe that kind of money. So certain things that I think would be wonderful to do for my fellow man will probably have to wait because we spent a lot of that money on God knows what.
There's, you know, political humor with teeth and political humor that's toothless. I'm wondering if you can think of examples of a kind of political humor that you think of as just like really bland and unnecessary, and something that's, you know, something with teeth, that the kind of humor that I imagine you'd prefer.
Yes, I despise the kind of joke that's just the generic, you know, yeah, Congress did this today. They want a bunch of, you know, just like they're all bad. That kind of where, and you know, who can't get cheap applause? Just being firing some broadside about how awful politicians are or how dumb Congress is. That's usually anything that inspires that kind of cheap applause just irks me. I mean, I see it on my show, and I think I get the smartest crowd studio audience in television comes to my show. But there's something about when you say certain things, you know, we just had a baby. Apply, yay, yay, yay.
Right, yeah.
Yes, I've been making love to my wife every night. Woo, woo. And it's the same thing with politics. You say certain hot-button things, and people applaud, and it's just cheap. I refuse. I've always refused to do that. Nothing noble about it. It's just it just seconds me. So probably I go too far, you know. I mean, I probably blame the people as much as the politicians, and the people will probably rise up and hate me for it one day. But I'm sorry, I really do believe that, you know, we get the politicians we deserve.
Give me an example of something that you think really has teeth.
Oh, well, gosh. Certainly in our monologues every night, we try to do... I mean, I did a joke about the Admiral Borden. Somebody took me to task for it. And, you know, it was a tragedy, but then again, I didn't think it was so out of bounds that it couldn't be joked about.
What'd you say?
But maybe I'm wrong. I'm not quite sure. I think it had something to do with... Clinton had just appointed his replacement, Admiral J. Johnson, I believe. And the paper said that he was one of the Navy's fastest rising stars. And I said, yes, he's rising so fast, I expect he might kill himself by the end of the summer. Which I'm sure is in bad taste. But, you know, if once in a while you don't go over the line, you don't know where the line is.
Now, what did you know stand-up comedy from records, from nightclubs, from the Borscht Belt, from television?
Yeah, I would say television more than anything. I mean, when I was a little kid, Ed Sullivan was still on, and that was probably the premier forum for it. I would see Alan King and, I mean, Carlin, Pryor, Robert Klein. They all did Ed Sullivan and Merv Griffin, shows like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was a little older, I was able to stay up and watch The Tonight Show. And then there was a lot of comics there. And, of course, Johnny was a great comic. And, you know, I didn't have to see him too many times before I realized, oh, that's the job I want.
I want to
be the guy who brings the comics on. You know, I want to be City Hall so I don't have to fight it.
I remember one night when I was watching your show, I think it was Sandra Bernhardt spit in the face of a very conservative guest. So I was wondering, she's such a performance artist. I mean, you never know what's real and what's performance in her life. But I was wondering if there were any repercussions or if the guest was, you know, because I saw the guest again afterwards, I'm pretty sure.
Yes, we had him back. John Lofton is his name. He is, excuse me, a fundamental Christian preacher guy, whatever, I don't know his exact title. I know that I got a lot of letters from Christians who said, don't think he represents us.
Mm-hmm.
Even they didn't like him too much.
What occasioned Sandra Bernhardt to spit in his face? What did he...
Well, he was going on and on about her in the Jewish religion. He said in the Jewish religion, you couldn't even speak, which I guess is some reference to an archaic Jewish law about, you know, I mean, religions have some pretty sexist laws on the books going way back. And I think there is, I'm not really sure, having not been raised Jewish myself, but there's something about not being able to speak. Maybe it's in temple, or I don't know what he was referring to exactly, but it was vaguely familiar. And of course, she just, you know, it just pushed every button in Sandra the wrong way. I mean, you know, to say to a Jewish bisexual performance artist that you can't speak, not a good thing.
Bill Maher is the host of Politically Incorrect, which moved to ABC TV this week following Nightline. Our interview was recorded last June. Coming up, Sarah Jessica Parker. This is Fresh Air. This is sure a good time to see Sarah Jessica Parker. She's featured in the films First Wives Club, Mars Attacks, and The Substance of Fire. She's also starring in the new Broadway production of Once Upon a Mattress. Earlier in her career, she starred opposite Steve Martin in L.A. Story, Nicolas Cage in Honeymoon in Vegas, and Johnny Depp in Ed Wood. Sarah Jessica Parker started her acting career as a child in theater productions, including a year-long stint on Broadway as Annie when she was 14. 2 years ago, she told me that her parents encouraged her artistic inclinations and were thrilled when, as a girl, she landed a part in a Harold Pinter production of The Innocents. The play starred Claire Bloom, who was living with Philip Roth. These were people her parents were enamored of. Sarah Jessica Parker remembers this as an idyllic time.
Both Harold and especially Claire took sort of a personal interest in my well-being and took care of me. I mean, Claire would make me come to dinner with her because I was on the road away from my family. She'd make me come to dinner with her and only eat fresh vegetables, and she would check and see what I was reading all the time, and she would make sure whatever city that we went to on the road before we came into Broadway that I took ballet classes with the ballet company that was affiliated with the city. And she used to say to me all the time, you know, please don't become a professional child. I worry, you know, whatever happens, just don't become a professional child.
When she said a professional child, did she mean a professional child actor or someone who makes a profession out of being a kid?
The latter, yes. Oh. She was really worried about cutesy, you know. She was worried about that polished showbiz sort of young Ethel Merman thing. The same thing my parents were. That was their biggest concern, was that I turn into like a commodity of some sort. And well, they knew the limitations of that, obviously.
Speaking of young Ethel Merman, hey, you were Annie on stage for 2 years. That's young Ethel Merman training school.
I know. I was the blemish. I don't know. To this day, I'm not certain how that all happened. I mean, I'm very grateful for the experience, and I loved it. But I was, as my father said when we first saw that show, we got standing room and we went to see it right after it opened on Broadway. And he said, oh, you know, Sarah Jessica, you're not Annie material. And I said, you know, why, beyond the vocal, you know, limitations that I had? And he said, you know, you just don't, you don't look it, you don't sound it, you know. The girls were built physically a certain way that I was just not, although I felt my physical presence was appropriate for the Depression era. I thought they all should be wayfish and, you know, look like they were eating off of rationed food stamps and things like that. But my father said no, because the girls were stronger than me. But it was one of those crazy flukes. You know, when you're a kid, nothing really matters, so you audition and you have no fear, and you end up, you accumulate a lot of things that you don't realize are difficult to get later in life.
What was the best and worst part of being Annie?
The best part was singing with a live orchestra every night, you know, like a 30-piece orchestra or something crazy like that. And the people that I met who I simply adored. And I think the worst part was trying to define myself when I left the show, being, you know, having a really hard time internally trying to figure out what I wanted and who I was, not what everybody else wanted me to be, meaning in the theater community. That was a really kind of awkward period for me.
What did people want you to be?
Well, I just think they wanted me to sing really loudly, you know. People wanted me to do Broadway musicals after I left the show, and I really, you know, the minute I left the show, within hours, my hair was dyed back to my own color, and I wanted to go to high school and, or at least be around, you know, regular children my age, and I wanted to be part of something where I was one of many and not alone. And I don't think that's what people in the theater community had in mind. I mean, legitimately, they wanted me to, you know, be a big singer. And you know, I'd come from straight drama, you know, I'd come from Harold Pinter and Claire Bloom, and you know, the television experiences that I had had in Cincinnati were all about, you know, high drama crises, and I thought I was a serious actress, and I thought that was just a fluke that this had happened in Annie. And I was, you know, like I said, I was proud to be one of the Annies, but I was afraid it was going to retard the rest of my career in some way.
I think the first time I saw you perform was in Square Pegs, the TV series that was on in, what, 82, I think it was.
Yep, 82 or 83. Yeah, 82.
And you played a high school student, and you know, you had a best friend who both thought of yourselves as being you know, really out of it, not ready for the cool crowd, but
right.
But you were probably the most interesting girls in the school, right?
Oh, well, I think we were.
Yeah. So I liked that series a lot. It didn't last on TV very long, but
no.
it was good. Was that a good experience for you?
Yeah, it was a great experience, and I think. You know, I happen to have had really good experiences in television, and they've all been really short-lived. They've all...
Oh, Equal Justice?
Equal Justice, and a show right before that called A Year in the Life. But all of my television experiences have been critically very successful and creatively very satisfying. And Square Pegs was really, I think, great because it was my first real experience in Los Angeles, and it was so different. And my parents up to that point had been so wary of me doing a television series and had done everything that they could kind of to stop it. And this was a smart show, and it was sophisticated, and it was so unique. And that was my first experience really in Hollywood, you know. And I was working with such good people. And so for me, I think it in the end ultimately allowed me to continue to work in television because I assumed that all my experiences would be like that, and I wasn't turned off by it. I think the only down part of that was the impact for a long time that it had on my career in terms of people thinking of me as anything other than Patty Green, which was my name on the show. You know, I was for 10 years playing the cerebral best friend, you know, of the pretty girl.
What was the first role where you felt like you were not only playing an adult, but you were playing a three-dimensional and sexual adult?
Although some might disagree with me, I would have to say L.A. Story in terms of film. Even though she was, you know, just for lack of a better word, she was a bimbo. She was Steve Martin's bimbo and was a lot more complicated. And I think she obviously was someone who operated, you know, from her own, like from the point of view of her sexuality. And she was an adult. And that was the first time I'd ever really been given an opportunity to play that.
Now, how much older is he than you?
Oh, gosh. Well, I'm 29, so he's maybe just in his 50s.
So he's about 20 years older.
Yeah.
No, one of the things that women in Hollywood complain about all the time is that older men get roles and older women
right.
don't, you know, mature women don't. So you always have younger women playing opposite older men. Was there anything that was uncomfortable about that for you?
Not a thing. I mean, politically, even it wasn't, because that was exactly her part in the movie. Her, you know, Victoria Tennant would say in the film, yeah, I mean, you're so obvious, you're so common, you know, you're choosing to spend time with somebody who doesn't threaten you or doesn't challenge you, you know, it's so easy, you just run off with some sort of, you know, little chippy. So it wasn't hard to play it, and obviously he wasn't hard to play opposite at all. I mean, quite the contrary. He was just, he was dreamy, you know. But I do know what you're talking about. I mean, there is a huge discrepancy. I mean, if a more mature woman were to play opposite a younger man, it would be a huge issue. It would be a cover story on every entertainment magazine, you know. Big risks taken in Hollywood.
You're right. Well, you know, that reminds me of a bit of a sidebar here. Your stepfather, I believe, is about 8 years younger than your mother.
Yeah. I think he may be even 9 years younger than my mother.
That's becoming much more accepted now than it probably was when they were married. Did that ever make you uncomfortable around friends? Did they ever think it was odd? And were you ever asked to, you know, defend it?
You know what? It never once came up. My mother, maybe it's because my mother always, she looks very young. She always has, and she's very small, and maybe that's why, but it's interesting. It's just, you're the first person that's mentioned. It's never come up. But, you know, my family was kind of strange anyway, so I guess they just assumed, if anyone thought about it, that it was just all part of the weird package.
What else was strange about your family?
Oh, you know, we were real messy, and we didn't have any matching linens or furniture, and we were very, you know, we were very poor, and our house was really an eyesore to the neighborhood. In fact, the sheriff would come over on more than one occasion and tell us to clean up our yard. We somehow always managed to move into these very wealthy, beautiful old neighborhoods with lots of fancy people, good people often, but fancy, because the schools were good. So my parents would manage to get a house in these nice neighborhoods, and we were always, you know, we were unsightly, we were unseemly, we were an eyesore. My parents screamed and yelled at each other, and the neighbors could hear. And
did anybody ever call the police?
Oh, they may have. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised. But you know, this, I'm not talking too much out of school here. I mean, this is kind of, I mean, it's now kind of one of those, some of those, the funny stories you tell at Christmas.
Did you have the lawn? You know how every neighborhood has a family that has a lawn with like old tires on it, and old like wrought iron things that nobody knows what they are. And
well, worse,
metal things.
Well, we had no grass, and we had a tire swing.
Right.
But guess where everybody congregated?
On the tire swing.
No. Our yard. All the kids,
the whole
neighborhood. Of course, because we were the fun house. You know, we were allowed to sit on the furniture. We were allowed to roller skate. In fact, we were encouraged to roller skate in our house, because if you opened all the doors, it went in a full circle like a donut. So we were allowed to roller skate inside and ride our bikes inside. And kids would come in and out of our house. And my mom would actually make cookies and bring them out. And people hung out in our front yard because it was the fun, relaxed house. You know, your parents were politically very relaxed, and they were groovesters, and that's exactly what our house looked like. And you know, our vegetables came from a co-op or whatever, I don't know, whatever that is. I mean, they were, you know.
So they were messy, but they were bohemians.
They were messy bohemians, but it was strange because there was also the strange dichotomy. My mother was incredibly strict and puritanical in a lot of the other ways that she raised us. It was very, very complicated and hard to understand as a child.
Strict about what?
Oh, well, you know, all the boys had to wear like navy blue wool Eton suits with Peter Pan collars, and they wore like lederhosen in the dead of winter and little shorts. And the girls wore always hand smock dresses and plaids, tartans, and saddle oxfords and little tiny white socks. And we always had our hair in perfect big Russian bows, you know. And we looked, when we'd go to the opera every night and the ballet and the symphony and stuff, and we sort of like, my mother raised us, actually, timely as it is, she raised us exactly how Rose Kennedy raised her children. That's exactly what she modeled herself after.
Well, I could see how you would definitely get mixed messages between roller skating around the house and having the bows in your hair.
Exactly, with like, you know, roaches in your house and, you know, strange vermin. And yet you'd walk outside and we would really look like old money rich kids, like good old fashioned, you know, Roman Catholic. And we were, first of all, some of us are Jews. Some of us are, we don't know what we are. Some of us were baptized. And it was crazy.
Sarah Jessica Parker, recorded in 1995. This is Fresh Air. We end today's show by remembering Catherine Scorsese, the mother of Martin Scorsese. She died Monday at the age of 84. Martin Scorsese cast her as a mother in several of his films. Here she is in King of Comedy as the mother of Rupert Pupkin, played by Robert De Niro. Pupkin is a lonely guy who wants to be the next King of Comedy. He spends his time in his basement imagining that he's kibitzing with the stars on the late-night talk shows.
And now, from New York, it's the Jerry Langford Show, with Jerry's guests, Richard Pryor, Ben Gazzara, Elizabeth Ashley,
Carol Burnett. And the comedy find of the year, making his television debut, Rupert Pupkin, the new
Rupert.
King of comedy.
Rupert, are you crazy?
Say
what's
hello
the matter with you?
Yeah,
oh,
Mom.
You fell sleeping. Lower it. What's the matter with you?
Mom!
Take it easy. Lower it.
I'm not going to lower it. I have to do this now.
I don't mind you playing it, but lower it.
Catherine Scorsese sometimes cooked for the cast and crew of her son's movies. Just before she died, she had a book published called Italian American, the Scorsese Family Cookbook. The cover photo is a still from this memorable scene in Goodfellas, in which she played Joe Pesci's mother. In the scene, Pesci has brought Robert De Niro and Ray Liotta home to mother for a late-night dinner after the guys worked up an appetite beating up a mobster they had feuded with. The barely alive mobster is locked up in the trunk of their car outside the house as they sit down to dinner.
So tell me, where have you been? I haven't seen you. You haven't even called or anything. Where have you been?
Well, Mom, I've been working nights.
And?
Well, tonight we were out late. We took a ride on the... out to the country, and we hit one of those deers. That's where the blood came from. I tell you, Jimmy told you before. I won't change. Anyway, you know, it reminds me, I need this knife. I'm gonna take this. It's okay.
Okay, yeah.
I just need it for
bring
a little
it back,
while.
Though. You know.
Well, the poor thing. You know, I hit him, and his. We hit the deer, and his paw. What do you call it?
The hoof.
Got caught in the grill. Oh. I gotta hack it off.
Ooh.
Ma, it's a sin. You're gonna leave it there, you know. So anyway, I'll bring your knife back after I do that.
Anyway.
Delicious.
Thank you. Why don't you get yourself a nice girl?
I get a nice one almost every night, Ma.
Yeah, but get yourself a girl so you could settle down. That's what I mean.
I settle down almost every night, but then in the morning I'm free. I love you. I want to be with you.
Why don't you settle down?
Catherine Scorsese died Monday at the age of 84. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Joyce Lieberman. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from The People vs. Larry Flint, a Milos Forman film now at theaters everywhere. This is NPR, National Public Radio.